it seems like the gift of poets and songwriters to kind of find that pair of lines or that couplet or that kind of image with words and melody that pulls a big idea or truth into a little better focus for a moment. And I have a vague, and I can't be specific about it because I can't remember where the song was. I'm pretty sure it's a John Foreman tune, but I don't think it's a Switchfoot song. But a song where he talks about, he has this line that says that we can tell what we believe by observing what we fear. And that one just hasn't gone away for me. That feels like one of those, Tyrion's shaking his head, it's not a Switchfoot song. Okay. I think it is John Foreman. Fiction Family. We'll go look it up. We can tell what we believe by observing what we fear. I gave our little dog, Mika, this hard plastic football, about this big, this week, to play with, and she just wrestled with this thing endlessly and really vigorously, and she kept returning to it, but she couldn't get her mouth around it, and maybe that was why she kept returning to it. It was just a little too big and a little too hard. She couldn't pick it up, but she just worried this thing. And that sort of feels like, this idea feels like that to me. I keep coming back to it and wrestling with it, and I'm intrigued with it, and I'm frustrated by my limitations all at the same time. When I come to this one, I can tell what I believe or trust by observing what I fear. So that idea kind of feels like it's on my radar all the time. It's not always front and center, but it's always there. Sometimes it's just kind of quietly beeping away, and then sometimes it goes off like a siren. Usually it goes off like a siren when I read the news. I'm gonna put you in that position, whether you wish to be or not. Well, of course, the danger of going to anything communal, isn't it? This is from the September 22nd issue of Maclean's, from the Good News, Bad News page, from the bad news side. The slug is Russian roulette. In case there was any doubt, Dutch air safety investigators have concluded that Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 broke up in the sky over eastern Ukraine last July because, quote, a large number of high-energy objects, close quote, ripped apart its fuselage. While the Russian-backed rebels suspected of firing those objects are currently adhering to a shaky ceasefire with Ukrainian forces, their patron, Vladimir Putin, is hardly backing down. Facing new sanctions, his government is vowing to retaliate by closing Russian airspace to Western carriers, and a Canadian warship in the Black Sea was buzzed by three military planes in a clearly provocative challenge. Where will it end? Well, aside from the editorial perspective that represents, which is clearly visible, what struck me about it was the last line. Tyrion, could you help me with something? Could you just go back to the soundboard? And there's a channel in there that's marked headset. It's way down the list somewhere. Channel 12, 11, something like that. HD set. Can you see it? Just turn it down a tad, okay? Thank you. There we go. What struck me about the piece was that last line, where will it end? And the reason I think it sticks in my kind of mental socks a little bit, like a bit of a burr, is because what it does is it feeds directly into the shared human experience of fearing what we don't know. Where will it end? We don't know. That's scary. We fear the unknown, but why do we fear the unknown? Well, there's maybe lots of reasons for that, but one of them, I think, is because it sort of clarifies this nightmare that a lot of us have about being out of control, because we fear the unknown because we fear losing our grip on whatever it is that gives us a sense of security. And our human drive to self-secure, our human drive to feel secure, is way up there. Like, it's up there with, I need food and I need shelter. It's just a huge driver for us as humans, and it's a built-in driver. I think there's lots of ways we could understand that, but I think the phrase, where will it end, is a very telling kind of condensation of something we fear, because to address ourselves to it, we have to face the possibility that the answer is, we don't know. And that is frightening. Perhaps if what I fear points me toward what I really believe, as Foreman suggests in his song, then if I think about this situation that this little blurb in Maclean's talked about, then perhaps what I believe is that knowledge, in this case knowing where it will end, is somehow a saving thing. It's what will save me. It's what will address my fear. Where will it end? Well, if I can say, I know where it will end, then whatever else I might fear about that, it's not the unknown. And maybe that's why, at least for me, when I run into something like that, or into lots of different things in my life, I tend to press into them kind of head first, idea first. And I'm not saying this is the human condition, this is just my condition. But that's kind of what I do. And I think maybe that's why when I need to change what I believe or have to let go of something that I thought I knew, which seems to happen a lot at this stage of life, I find the experience a combination that's not unlike the experience that I have in community time. I find it exhilarating on the one hand to kind of face into that. On the other hand, I find it really disconcerting. And so maybe it's a little bit, it's kind of like ideological bungee jumping, you know? It's like, wee-oh, I'm going to die. And then, you know, they're kind of both going on at the same time. And I realize that's one way to kind of characterize an experience of fear, but it doesn't always behave like that. It's not always just disconcerting and exhilarating mixed together. Sometimes fear is debilitating. I'm going to talk quite a bit about fear this morning, and I want to be both gentle in that, and I also want to be forthright, because I know that to experience the debilitating kind of fear is more than unpleasant. It's the sort of thing that can kind of toss our life into the deepest sort of disarray and anguish. And so I just wanted to say before I kind of got into any more of this that if that's your experience or the experience of someone close to you, I want you to know that I'm going to explore some of these ideas today, but I am conscious as I do it of that aspect of fear, and I don't want to be blithe about that suffering, and I don't want to be insensitive to it. I also don't want us to not explore something that is important, and I would use a word like primal, that's right down there at the bottom of our human experience. I want to read you one other bit from this particular issue of Maclean's. It's from an interview with Naomi Klein. She's a well-known Canadian journalist and activist. She's called in the preface to this particular interview the left's most visible and controversial figure. I wonder what it's like to live with that. She has a book out this week, just coming out. The book is called This Changes Everything, Capitalism and the Climate. And one of the things she talks about in the interview is how the book itself is aimed at what she calls, quote, the disengaged... It's my doppelganger. Kieran came running around the corner to me. He said, Dad, I found your mini-me. So he takes me around the corner and shows me Atticus's shirt. Good caller, Addy. That's going to make no sense to anyone who's listening to the podcast. She says that the book is aimed at what she calls, quote, the disengaged center, people who believe it. And what she means by that is that we're headed for a climate-related catastrophe and very nearly out of time to act. So people, the book is aimed at the disengaged center, people who believe that is the case and yet feel hopeless. And toward the close of the interview, her interviewer asks her about that mission, that trying to get people to engage, to act. And this is just that little question and answer portion. The interviewer says, I thought you could have painted a more terrifying portrait of what awaits us if we continue to drag our feet. Were you worried about opening yourself to the same critiques you've leveled at free marketers in The Shock Doctrine, which is another book, and I won't kind of give you all the context for that. And this is her reply. She says, it's not that I'm afraid of that critique. It's that I don't want quibbling about the science. This is how a lot of the debate gets derailed. I don't want to be derailed with quibbles about how many hurricanes there were in 2012. If I've failed to impress upon the readers the severity of this crisis, that's a failure. I try to paint a picture at the beginning of the book of the stakes, what it means that we have the World Bank telling us we're on a 4 to 6 degree temperature trajectory when a 2 degree event would be a catastrophe. To be in decade zero and out of time, to sort of unpack that at the start of the book and then leave it behind. I even played with having none of it in the book, not because I'm afraid of it, but because I think people's eyes glaze over a little bit. I think, and this is the bit that kind of caught my attention in our context today, I think this is one of the ways in which we have failed to deal with this crisis. We just think we can scare people, and then they'll become active. Actually, scaring the hell out of people makes them want to curl up in a ball. actually scaring the hell out of people makes them want to curl up in a ball. When I read that, it felt like one of those moments where you read something and it kind of comes into your world like trailing clouds of a greater wisdom. You know, these tendrils of something bigger going on are just streaming off this idea. And for me, that's how that comment felt. And it felt like it was about this same idea, that we can tell what we believe or trust by examining what we fear, but that same examination can immobilize us. It can just make us curl up in a fetal ball instead of moving us to act. And maybe that's got something to do with another belief, which is that we will be saved from what we fear primarily by discerning what the right thing is to do and then doing it ideally just right. Or if we can't manage to do it just right, then at least by doing it enough. I don't know if that sounds recognizable to you, but if I think about the way that things that we fear in our culture tend to be addressed, particularly in mass media, what comes readily to mind is the pervasive presence of a being that I'm just going to call the expert. I think we probably know how this works, right? The talk show sets up the problem. Usually that's pretty easy to do. You just pick a disaster and you either hint or outright tell me how it's going to possibly happen to me. So now we have a felt dilemma. And then what you do is you call in an expert, right? And what the expert does is either tell me what is likely to happen next, and this will either exacerbate my fear because the expert says it's just around the corner from you personally, or it's going to relieve my fear because it isn't. And then they tell me what to do to either avert the disaster or keep it out of my backyard. I realize I'm painting with a pretty broad strokes here, but by way of patterns in our culture around fear, I think we can see this one. This perks away all around us all the time. So for me, for example, to avoid getting swept up in the rising tsunami of dementia and related illnesses, I need to adjust my diet. I need to get certain kinds and amounts of exercise. I need to make sure my social world is varied and it has face-to-face interactions in it, and so on and so forth. I didn't just pull that one out of the hat. My grandmother suffered with dementia, progressive dementia, for the last decade of her life. My father's recovering from an unanticipated brain injury, and I'd forget my head at home if it wasn't attached on any given day when I'm under stress. Right? So when the dementia story comes on, or a whole series of them, this has been on the case with CBC's Current last month, I'm like, wait a minute. This disaster might already be in my backyard. And then the expert says, do these things. And address yourself to this. Is that the redress of the fear? I think the irony for me of a list like that is that it's more likely to scare the hell out of me and make me curl up in a ball than it is to get me to act. And when I face that and I ask myself, why is that the case for me? The closest I can get is to think that maybe somewhere deep down, either in my intuitive knowing or in the narrative that I've grown up with and I try to live out of, or somewhere, I suspect that knowing what to do and doing enough of it isn't actually the deepest redress of fear. Don't go all binary on me and hear me saying it is not important. It is important. Do not hear me saying these are things not worth doing. That is not the point. The point is that there's something left unaddressed by this set of ideas about fear and what to do with it. And I want to introduce us this morning an idea that needs a lot more exploring than we have time for on any given morning here, but we're going to come back to it again. So I'm more or less going to introduce it this morning in the context of the parable that I said we'd explore. If we were going to strip away all the layers of being told, and this is impossible, but if we could try, if we could strip away all the layers of the things we've been told that the story Jesus is telling is about, and in particular, if we could sort of strip away what we carry into a moment like this about what the first four books of the Second or New Testament say the story is about, so our preconceptions or previously taught ideas, if we could strip those away and we could go back and read what's often called the Gospels with fresh eyes, I think we might make a very interesting and, I believe, a really important discovery. Most of us, if we go up with any kind of Christianity, would probably say that the story as Jesus spoke into it is primarily about sin and forgiveness. And goodness knows, that understanding of the story is what drives the business of religion, for sure. And of course, the story does address itself to those themes rather directly, but If we were to take a fresh look at what themes Jesus camps out on, we would discover pretty quickly that in terms of what the Gospels have to say, his take on sin is that we should confess it, we should know that it's forgiven, and we should move on. But what he gives serious time to, what he comes back to over and over and over again, and it's not only the theme that Jesus comes back to, but pretty nearly every non-destructive spirit in the story addresses itself to this theme, and that theme is fear. And the message invariably, in every shape, is don't be afraid. I think that's incredibly intriguing. For a long time, I've believed that the reason that the angels in the biblical story always seem to use fear not as their opening line is because they must be really fearsome beings. When they show up, everybody's just like, you know, peeing their pants. And so the first thing they have to say is, it's okay, right? If that's an angel, I've never seen one. I've never had that experience. And I'm not quite ready to believe that they're that rare. But for some reason, that's the first thing they say. And I've always sort of accounted for that in the story by thinking that must just be alarming. But what if that's the opening line, not because angels are so fearsome, but because of the prevalence of fear in the human experience? And given the recurrence of that theme throughout the Gospels, maybe the angels and Jesus are just acknowledging reality the way we perceive it, and they're addressing themselves to our prevailing problem, which is fear. How about that? Don't be afraid. Not because I'm fearsome, but because you started that way. Because before I showed up, you were scared. But you don't have to be. Let's talk about that. Let's consider that. Most of us in this room probably have some sense of what the story of the Good Samaritan is about. I mean, it's part of our cultural landscape. It's enough of a part of our Western cultural landscape that in Canada we have laws on the books that are titled this way. We have a Good Samaritan law, which is designed to protect the bystander that assists someone in distress from being sued. It doesn't work very well, but it's on the books. We have a large NGO that's more and more visible at this time of the year that's called the Samaritan's Purse, and that name is meaningful in the cultural context to some degree. And so it's out there. This story is part of our collective memory. But I'm going to mess with it a little bit this morning. The story, as most of us kind of know it, and as I mentioned in the blurb, and by the way, just an aside, thanks to all of you that have been getting a hold of me, and it's not like it's been a tidal wave of you, but there have been a few who just said, add my name to that list. If you want to know what's going on at the table week by week, that's the best thing to do, is just be in touch and get your name on that list. So thanks for doing that. As I mentioned in that blurb, this story, the story we often call the story of the Good Samaritan, is the story of Jesus answering a trick question from a smart person about who is my neighbor. But it's worth remembering when we dive into this next part of our exploration this morning that the initial question from that same lawyer in this case was, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Now, there's another sentence that it's hard to strip all our previous stuff off of. But Jesus actually addresses himself to that a little later in the story, so we'll come to that. So as the story goes, and as most of us recall it, the broad outlines of the narrative, there's a person making a journey alone. That person gets mugged, robbed, and beaten to within an inch of their life. A priest comes by, sees the beat-up guy, and gives him wide berth. And then another religious guy comes by, and he does the same thing. And along comes a culturally marginalized person, and he takes pity on the beaten-up character. He bandages him up, he takes him to an inn, lays down his credit card for any and all expenses, and he promises to check up on him on his return trip to boot. And it's a great story. There's a reason it has cultural traction. It's an inspiring story. It is challenging. It's so broadly applicable that it would motivate all kinds of people, not just people who would look at the text and go, this is a sacred text or this is a word from God. It's just a great, inspiring story, at the least. But there is a problem, at least from my vantage point. And one way to open and consider that problem is to examine the possibility that the parable, and again, this is editorial stuff, I harp on this all the time, but in our English translations, I'm going to contend that this is another misnamed parable. Because calling it the parable of the Good Samaritan pretty much inevitably sets up its hearers to take it as the story of a hero that offers them a good example for imitation. It's the story of the Good Samaritan. They're the hero. That's who you look to in the story to figure out what to do, who to imitate. The problem with that is that it's got some kinship with the experts that we talked about earlier. We could think about it this way: problem. We live in a rotten world in which bad things happen, like innocent and perhaps naive people getting the tar beaten out of them while they're traveling. Solution? Expert says, don't be like the religious guys in the story. Be like the Samaritan. Be compassionate and kind. Is that a good idea? Absolutely. Is the Samaritan a good example? Best one in the story, for sure. Does Jesus say we should follow the example of the Good Samaritan? Well, it's pretty hard to dodge it. It's in the text. He says, go and do likewise at the end of the story. So what's the problem? The problem is that from a Christian vantage point, the expert on how to live, if you want to walk in the way of Jesus, is Jesus. We're not actually invited, under Christian spirituality, to walk in the way of the Good Samaritan. We're actually invited, if we want to follow the Jesus way, to walk in the way of Jesus. This is not the way of a detached expert. It's the way of an embedded guide. Totally different idea. And that way, as much as doing good is a good idea, is not ultimately about doing good or doing better. And this is where we hit the rub of the problem. Because at the core of what we would call the way of Jesus is the much less likely but more profound invitation to walk in a way that leads through death to life. That's different than just doing good or doing better. It's profoundly different. And in the story of the Good Samaritan, it's pretty easy to correlate the actions of the Good Samaritan with the character of Jesus, to say the Good Samaritan is the surrogate for Jesus in the story. And when we do, what we get is a lovely image of Jesus caring for the last and the lost and the least in the world, and we get the kind of inspiration that gives us a Mother Teresa, and I would defy anyone to demonstrate to me that caring for those on the margins is a bad thing. The problem with that is that given what Jesus has been trying to get his followers to understand in one story after another, is that the Good Samaritan is not the surrogate for Jesus in this parable. The surrogate for Jesus in this parable is the guy who gets beat up. The surrogate for Jesus is the guy who is on the way to death. Not the Good Samaritan. And that is exactly what Jesus has been hammering away at all the way along, that the world, if it's going to be saved, is not going to be saved by all of us becoming better religious rule keepers. And if we were wondering about that question when we started to read the parable, all we have to do is look at the behavior of the two best rule keepers in the story, the two religious guys, to know the answer. What happens in the story to rule keepers when push comes to shove? Well, when they get the hell scared out of them, what do? Exactly what Naomi Klein suggested we're all prone to, which is curl up in a ball. Walk around the problem on the other side, whatever shape it takes in our actions, but not act. We can be religious in the extreme and walk right past the truth about Jesus in this story. Because the story Jesus is telling is one that says that the way to life is a way that passes through death. This is one of the reasons I'm just going to sound a little sick, but I hope we can talk about it enough that it makes sense. But this is one of the reasons I enjoyed my conversation with you this morning, Kathy, about your friend who suicided. And why I appreciated the words you chose when you prayed about this chapter of her life. See, the most mystical, curious, absurd thing about the core of the idea that burbles away inside all things that is Christendom when it's doing what it should do, when it's moving in the way of Jesus, is this bizarre idea that we don't ultimately have anything to fear. Easy to say, hard to do, right? That's why it's called a way. Not a destination. This is a thing we move into. This is a thing we learn by living into it. But if we take it seriously, it changes the way we regard everything. Even a story like Lisa's story, which we're not trying to deny the tragedy by regarding it out of this perspective. It is tragic. It is achingly heartbreakingly filled with sadness. And there's a community that is grieving. We get to share that a little bit. That's a gift to us and a gift to them. But it is not ultimately fearsome. Because the entry price, Jesus says, to new life is no more and no less complex than death. If you remember the parable of the seed sown everywhere, no soil where this isn't sown. No soil where this isn't sown. I know this is the kind of thing that would get me burned at the stake in some parts of the Christian community, should we still be doing such a thing. But I am not concerned for Lisa in any ultimate cosmic God's goodness sense of concern. Don't try to make me concerned, because that'll piss me off. That'll make me really mad, because I think that's somewhere really close to the core of the problem here. And I think that's why Jesus is trying in so many different ways to tell this story in a way that everyone around him, even the, and they've got proximity, man. It's not like the distance we have from this story. They're right there. And they're kind of going, this isn't even plausible. What's plausible is that we have to earn this. What's plausible is that the world gets saved by us figuring out what the rules are and doing them better and better and better until utopia blossoms. And Jesus is saying, nothing wrong with doing well by doing good. Nothing wrong with doing good and doing it well. Dive in. You watch the way Jesus lived his life, and he was in there up to his eyebrows with doing what was right and good. But it's not the thing that saves us from the thing we ultimately fear, the big fear that is at the root of all of our other fears. That thing that we fear is death. The irony, I suppose, of the lack of plausible idea here is that it's death itself that is the thing that we pass through to know what it was that we feared we wouldn't experience all along, which is life. Let's just loop this back to the beginning for a little bit. The pressing question that the lawyer asks at the beginning of this story, I didn't read it out loud, but some of us have it in our memory banks. When the lawyer asks Jesus how to live so that he doesn't have to fear death, Jesus says to him, what's the answer you already know? Great little Socratic moment, and the lawyer replies, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And what Jesus says, as we have the story on the page, is do this and you will live. Not you'll be okay when you die, not even you'll have life forever somewhere, someday. Just simply do this, and you will live. Live now, in this life, here, in this one, where we are afraid of so many things. Where does that freedom reside in this story? I think it resides hidden in plain sight. It resides in the battered, mostly dead character that's laying in the middle of the road. It doesn't reside in the Samaritan. He isn't doing something heroic as much as he's just joining a mostly dead man in his unlikely, doesn't look like a Messiah to me, journey down into death. He's just getting messy along with the passion of the guy in the middle of the road. By the time the Samaritan is done paying the bill, never mind getting his whole life messy with helping, he is all tangled up with the passion of the figure that is in the dirt. And that passion will lead that character, the surrogate for Jesus, in the larger story, down into death and through death into life. And so it seems to me that when we're invited to walk in the way of Jesus, we're invited to give up, to just utterly give up the idea that the way to really live is to get better and better at keeping a set of religious rules. We are invited, as Jesus points out at the beginning of the parable, to love God and others with our whole beings, including, presumably, the part of us that is quite naturally afraid and that wrestles so hard to find ways to save ourselves. What if we're exploring? It's one of the reasons it's the core reason why this community exists. So let me leave us with a what if. What if Jesus was on about something ultimately true here? What if we can't save ourselves, but we can only kind of ultimately give that up and trust that God is both good enough and big enough to do the work of saving, whatever that might mean to us. And that, as a corollary to that, What our job is to learn to let that project of saving ourselves go, so that we can be not just willing, but unafraid / less afraid to face the things that might seem like a threat to us, even when that's kind of as nuts and bolts as our fear of our neighbor. Peace.